the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Here's your host, Jim Poplava.
I want to get into the second part of your book. You've divided it into two sections. The first was dealing with the fallacies that we're bombarded with in the society we live in. We just talked about the blogosphere as an example. In the second half of your book, you talk about the truth and you deal with individual foods. Okay, the first one I want to deal with, this caught my interest, especially in reading the Blue Zones, where red wine was characteristic of their diets. Let's talk about alcohol and in particular wine. I've been told in moderation, one or two glasses a day. If you're male, maybe one. For female, it's good for your heart. Let's talk about alcohol and specifically wine.
Sure. And as you say, Jim, I divided the book up so that the whole first half is on these fallacies and how they get started and how you can defend against them. And then in the second part, I talk about the specific truth and in, sort of detailed focus on many topics like wine and grains and gluten and carbs and protein and so forth. So on the topic of alcohol, there was a recent big study that kind of shook everybody up because it looked across many countries and it concluded that the safest level of alcohol intake for populations was zero. And that was translated into headlines that said we've been wrong about alcohol. The idea that drinking some can confer a health benefit is wrong because zero is better than some. And so no alcohol is safe. So everybody should avoid it. And, there was a great deal of consternation over that. But the reality is this, studies that look at populations are very different from studies that look at individuals. So in a population of, 10,000 people, 100,000 people, a million people, if there's drinking, some people are going to drink irresponsibly. Some people are going to drink and drive. Some people are going to have bad stuff happen to them, and that's going to show up, and you're going to say that population would have been better off if there had been no alcohol. What it doesn't tell you is what about an individual who drinks at a very moderate level, very responsibly, doesn't drink and then drive, doesn't drink excessively. Is it still possible that person can derive pleasure from good wine with dinner and actually reduce their risk of heart disease into the bargain? And the answer is yes. Absolutely, that's still possible. Now, you mentioned the prudent doses, and that is in fact true, up to one drink a day for women, up to two a day for men, and a drink would be a beer, a small mixed drink in a tumbler or a glass of wine. And the reason for the difference is enzymatic. Men have about twice the alcohol dehydrogenase of women, and it's not just an issue of body size. Men just have more. We make more of this enzyme that metabolizes alcohol. So women experience the adverse effects of alcohol at lower doses than men. Even at those moderate doses, though, Jim, there is still potential for harm. So there is an increase in the risk of breast cancer in women with any alcohol intake. So, it's absolutely true that alcohol can do harm at almost any dose. On the other hand, it can do good as well. It does reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease. We know the mechanisms. It raises HDL cholesterol. It raises levels of something called TPA in the body, which helps to dissolve blood clots. So there are a number of ways in which alcohol can reduce cardiovascular risk. Whether or not alcohol is going to reduce your risk of bad health outcomes will depend on how much you drink, how often, how responsibly. Will also depend in part on what your health risks are at baseline. So, if you have heart disease risk factors and you're not at risk for other chronic diseases, alcohol may confer a net benefit. If you're a woman with a strong family history of breast cancer and no risk of heart disease, there's a reasonable chance that even very moderate alcohol intake will increase your risk of bad outcomes. So what's the bottom line after all of this? The bottom line is if you want to drink responsibly and moderately for the pleasure of it, I think you can, and I think you can do so safely, and you might even derive a health benefit. I would not, however, specifically recommend alcohol for a health benefit. There are far safer, far more reliable ways to get that. So I would, I am a fan, by the way, of good wine with a good meal, but I drink for pleasure, and, I try to do it moderately and responsibly and think I may be deriving a slight health benefit into the bargain. But the primary reason for a good glass of wine is it's delicious.
I want to talk about two other popular type of things that we consume in our society. Let's address chocolate. I've heard dark chocolate is good for blood pressure. And then coffee. It's good for preventing dementia. Let's talk about both of those.
Yeah. So, you know, I like to say, and actually this is a tagline we use on my wife's recipe site. We've taken all of the Katz family greatest hits, the stuff we actually eat and on which we raised our children, and my wife put it on a website that's available for everybody for free. That's at Cuisinicity.com. It's like Cuisine City with an I in the middle, Cuisinicity.com. And the tagline there is, love the food that loves you back, because we really believe in that. Good food should be a source of pleasure and a source of good health, because good health is also a source of pleasure. And maybe no food better epitomizes the opportunity to love food that loves you back than dark chocolate, because, you know, it's an indulgence, it's a treat. But the simple fact is, lots of scientific literature indicates health benefit from dark chocolate. It's a highly concentrated source of antioxidants called bioflavonoids. It has a number of other really interesting nutrient properties. It's really rich in fiber. It's very rich in magnesium, which helps lower blood pressure. It's very rich in arginine, which is an amino acid precursor to something called nitric oxide, which helps blood vessels dilate and improves blood flow. So lots of really interesting properties. There is a lot of saturated fat in the cocoa bean, but that saturated fat is mostly stearic acid. It's a particular kind of saturated fatty acid that is not associated with inflammation and is not associated with injury to blood vessels. So the saturated fat seems to be harmless, not beneficial, but not harmful. And then there are all these other nutrient properties that are beneficial. So the only downside to dark chocolate would be calories and the added sugar. And those would argue for being careful about the dose. You know, just because some of something's good doesn't mean more is better. So, you know, we're talking about maybe, you know, up to about an ounce a day on average would likely confer some health benefit. And again, you know, the main reason to eat dark chocolate is because you like it. And it is important here that, you know, we be specific. So dark chocolate has all these benefits. Milk chocolate does not, because much of the fat in milk chocolate is dairy fat, which is very different. Milk chocolate is lower in the cocoa, so it has much less of the antioxidants. It has much less fiber, much less magnesium, less arginine. So all the stuff that makes dark chocolate good gets diluted down in milk chocolate. So if you're going to eat chocolate, definitely go over to the dark side. But yes, dark chocolate is good for us. 60% cocoa or higher. And then the case is pretty much as convincing, but a little less strong for coffee. The typical American diet is pretty low, unfortunately, in fruits and vegetables and foods that are richest in antioxidants. So when you eat a diet that's low in antioxidant-rich foods, coffee shows up pretty high on the list of antioxidant sources. It's only a moderately good source, but compared to most stuff most Americans are eating, it comes out, you know, ahead of many other foods. So it's a good source of antioxidants. And then, of course, the caffeine in coffee is a stimulant, and it's a pretty safe stimulant for most people. If you have too much caffeine late in the day, it may keep you up at night. But for the most part, in moderate doses, you know, up to about 4 cups of coffee a day, people tolerate it very well. There are studies that show enhanced performance on various tests of cognition with caffeine. So you really do get some brain boost. It may enhance your productivity at work. So here too, you're getting a dose of antioxidants. You're getting some brain stimulation. And the net effect on health over time appears to be beneficial. I would say, you know, as with the chocolate, how you eat it is very important. So, you know, if you're adding lots of sugar to your coffee or you're adding lots of cream to your coffee, you completely change the equation. So, you know, what we know about the benefits of coffee mostly pertain to coffee in its native state. So just coffee. Be careful what you add to it.
Let's move on to another item that is so controversial in the diet sphere, and that is dairy and eggs. I have read studies that eggs, wholesome food, good source of protein, fat, etc., and others that are saying, hey, this leads to heart disease, it raises your cholesterol. If you have heart disease, stay off the stuff. So let's talk about dairy and eggs.
Okay, and let's unbundle the two because they're quite distinct. So let's talk about eggs first. So for many years, the party line was that dietary cholesterol contributed importantly to cholesterol levels in the blood, that was an important concern in terms of heart disease risk, and consequently, we should avoid eggs. And so that's sort of been mainstream thinking for a long time. Most of the literature that's looked specifically at egg consumption has failed to support that, has failed to show a strong association between eating eggs and eating dietary cholesterol and bumping up blood levels of cholesterol. Now, that doesn't mean it has no effect at all. It just means in the grand scheme of things, against the background of the typical American diet, which is not very good, eggs don't seem to be a particular concern. There's also the issue, and this is true about every topic in nutrition, and it's routinely neglected, instead of what? So, you know, when we advise people to give up eggs, if they had done that and started eating steel-cut oats with mixed berries and walnuts, well, yeah, actually, they would have been trading up. I mean, that's eggs may be fine, but that's you know, there you've got a super breakfast. So, yeah, you just traded that, but that didn't happen. America runs on Dunkin'. You know, we ate fewer eggs. We ate more donuts. We ate more muffins. We ate more bagels. Well, then we went from a food that was very filling and quite nutrient-rich. So, yes, there's cholesterol, but there's also excellent protein and quite a few micronutrients. We went to foods that were, you know, sort of nutritionally destitute and had no redeeming characteristics and highly refined carbohydrate and added sugar. We traded down. And so the net effect has probably been harm. So both the literature showing there isn't a really strong effect of eggs or dietary cholesterol on blood cholesterol, and the trends in the population showing that when we told people to stop eating eggs, they started eating stuff that's far less good for them, have led to the conclusion that we should revoke that message. And again, it doesn't mean we have evidence that eating eggs is good for people. You know, it's not as if Americans are egg deficient, but you know, they are a highly nutritious, very satiating food. You could do a lot worse. So I, you know, and that's, it's interesting, Jim, because in the book, you know, I tell these stories and I go one topic at a time and I lay out the pros and cons. People are used to, you know, it's all good or it's all bad, but you know, that's not the truth. The truth in the real world tends to be more nuanced than that. You know, very often you have to deal with shades of gray rather than just black and white. So, you know, are eggs the best thing you could eat for health? Absolutely not. We have no evidence in the scientific literature that anybody in the country is egg deficient or that you have to eat eggs to be healthy. But on the other hand, we know there are a lot of ways to eat worse. So you then have to decide what to do with that in terms of, you know, whether or not you make room for eggs in your own diet. In terms of dairy, it's much the same story. Instead of what? So, you know, there are studies showing benefit of dairy, and also there are questions about full-fat dairy versus low-fat dairy. But, you know, if you see a study that suggests the benefit of, say, drinking whole milk in children, you have to ask the instead of what question. And, you know, this is America. So it's, you know, it's not going to be instead of water. It's going to be instead of Coke or Pepsi. So absolutely. I think whole milk or skim milk is much better for kids than you know, soda. You know, against the background of the typical American diet, there probably is some potential benefit of adding dairy, whether it's full fat or low fat, to the diet. On the other hand, do we have evidence that the addition of dairy to, say, an optimal vegan diet confers benefit? Absolutely not. And then there are studies suggesting all sorts of potential harms associated from dairy consumption too. So you kind of have to revert back to the view from altitude and say, okay, what do we know when we put all the evidence together? And what we know is that the best health outcomes are associated with a wide variety of dietary patterns where neither eggs nor dairy is predominant. They are there at the periphery. They are small contributions. The overall pattern of the diet is mostly vegetables, fruits, whole grains, beans, lentils, nuts, and seeds. That's why it's interesting, Jim. It's a big book. But I say throughout the book, the truth about food, you know, it's simple. You can get that down to seven words. Michael Pollan did it. Eat food, not too much, mostly plants. But, you know, there's an awful lot of confusion at the margins. How do you sort that out? Well, just, you know, get the fundamentals right and then decide what works for you. So if you mostly eat those plant foods, wholesome, minimally processed, and you like to include some dairy in your diet, do it. If you like to include eggs occasionally, do it. Here's where things can, you know, the train can run off the tracks. Okay, so what if you tell me, all right, so I heard you, I'm supposed to eat mostly plants, but I like to eat eggs occasionally, and I like to eat meat occasionally, and I like to eat dairy occasionally. And by the time you're done adding up all those occasionallys, now your diet is mostly meat and dairy and eggs and not mostly plants anymore, well, then you've gone too far.
Let's talk about sugar and two kinds, fructose and fruit, because some will argue, well, gosh, if sugar is bad for you, then, well, fruit is bad for you because it's sugar as well.
So that's a huge mistake. First of all, we eat way too much added sugar. Added sugar absolutely is bad for us. We get a lot of it in soda. We get a lot of it in processed foods. But the idea that, you know, because sugar is bad or fructose is bad and there's fructose in fruit, therefore fruit must be bad, is just completely misguided. Oxygen is actually highly toxic to people in a concentrated form. You give somebody 100% oxygen, they'll be dead within 72 hours. That doesn't mean that breathing is a bad idea. Just try holding your breath for the next 2 hours and you'll see just what I mean. So, you know, same thing here. So, you know, you've got to breathe even though there's oxygen in the atmosphere. And eating whole fruit is really good for you, even though there's fructose in the fruit, which is part of what makes it taste so good. But in a whole fruit, that fructose is dilute. It's mixed up with fiber and pulp and a rich array of nutrients. The net effect of eating whole fruit is a lower risk of obesity, a lower risk of diabetes, a lower risk of insulin resistance, a lower risk of every bad thing. Eating whole fruit is good for people. So why would you avoid a food that's associated with all the good outcomes you would try to be getting by limiting your intake of sugar? It makes no sense. So it's just a huge mistake. So yes, there's fructose in fruit, but that is not the problem. The problem is when we take sweeteners, concentrate them, and add them to processed foods. Totally different exposure, totally different health effects. And then in terms of which kind of added sugar is bad for us, the answer is yes. It doesn't matter. You know, we eat way too much added sugar, and so people will carry on about whether it's, you know, sucrose, which is table sugar, or high fructose corn syrup. They're more alike than different. They are different, but the differences aren't really worth talking about. They're used to sweeten processed foods. We consume too much of both. By the way, you know, people may think that high fructose corn syrup is all about fructose. It's not. High fructose corn syrup in the food supply is generally about 55% fructose and 45% glucose. Compare that to table sugar, which is the same two sugars, fructose and glucose, but 50-50. So the difference is 50-50 versus 55-45. If those sound a lot alike, they should. They're more alike than different. And so again, the problem is added sugar to processed foods. But it's a mistake to think fruit contains sugar, I can't eat fruit. The net effect of eating fruit is less risk of all the things that added sugar in the diet actually contributes to.
I want to talk about a controversy on a new book that's out there, Doctor, and that is certain kind of plants in lectins are actually bad for us. I don't know. I have a hard time feeling that if I eat zucchini, a cucumber, or peppers, or some beans, that that's unhealthy food. But nonetheless, that's the thesis.
Yeah, and the thesis is nonsense. This book to me is an appalling, irresponsible attack on the public's understanding and on public health. And it just shows why we need to teach people how to fish, to go back to the beginning of our conversation, Jim. People really need to be defended, not just against yesterday's diet nonsense, but some new harebrained theory will come along tomorrow. And, you know, I really would like people to be immunized against that as well, because these things are dangerous. So this notion that there are protein-like compounds called lectins in a wide variety of foods, beans, lentils, whole grains, many vegetables, many fruits, nuts and seeds, that they could conceivably be harmful. And there's some studies you can cite that suggest they might theoretically be harmful, and therefore people need to avoid these foods. What's the problem with that? Well, everything is the problem with that. The reality is those are the foods most consistently associated with the best health outcomes. So, you know, how can you possibly say, okay, these foods contain a compound which could theoretically be harmful, therefore don't eat these foods, even though we know that eating these foods makes people healthier, not sick? It's, you know, it's just completely absurd and totally irresponsible. And here's the other thing, and people need to appreciate this. It's so easy, if you have some training in science, to go shopping for just those studies that support your point of view, even if those studies are in the minority. We call it cherry picking. And, you know, so you go to the peer-reviewed literature, you decide ahead of time what answer you're looking for, you search through thousands upon thousands of articles, which it's easy to do electronically, and you just search for the few that support your point of view. You put those in a book to the general public, which doesn't know the scientific literature on that topic, and you make it seem like those few studies are all there is. And what you leave out of the conversation is that for every one of those, there were 10 or 100 or 1,000 or 10,000 that said the opposite. I went searching after this book came out, arguing that we needed to avoid all the most nutritious foods because they contain lectins. I went searching the medical literature on lectins. I did find a few studies, mostly, you know, small animal studies suggesting that there was some potential harm from certain lectins. By the way, mostly in foods nobody eats, like uncooked beans. I don't know anybody who eats, you know, kidney beans or pinto beans or chickpeas uncooked. So, you know, mostly this is just theoretical nonsense. But for every study I found suggesting some potential harm of lectins, I found several suggesting potential benefits. There were even studies suggesting that certain lectins have anti-cancer properties. So what we knew at the start was the foods we're talking about, you know, as you just mentioned those foods you think are healthy. You're right. You know, the beans and the lentils and the whole grains and the zucchini, and yeah, they're good for you. So we already knew that the foods were good for us. So, you know, does that mean there's nothing in those foods with some potential harm? No, I mean, that, you know, every plant food has thousands of nutrient compounds in it. So the food can be good for you without every single thing in it being good for you. But even the lectins specifically, the literature on that topic is far from clear that they are harmful. But this book was put together by cherry-picking the literature and making an argument that I think is directly harmful to public health and directly harmful to the public's understanding of what's true about food.
I want to hit the topic of meat, because if you take a look at the U.S., we are a meat-oriented society. You take a look at the number of hamburger restaurants in this country, you go into a supermarket and take a look at the section that is devoted to meat. So let's talk about that, good or bad, or in moderation.
So, you know, we started having this conversation before when we were talking about dietary patterns and paleo. So first, 8 billion Homo sapiens on this planet simply cannot eat very much meat without destroying the planet, because it takes massively more acreage to turn plants into animal flesh, to eat the animal flesh, than just eating the plants ourselves. It takes massively more water, and it produces massively more greenhouse gas emissions. So in terms of our aquifers, in terms of our land use, in terms of climate change, I mean, all of these effects on the sustainability of this planet we all call home, massively affected by raising animals to eat their meat. We just can't afford to do it because there are too many of us. So there's the environmental argument. There's also the ethical argument, because in order to produce enough meat to feed a population of 8 billion people, inevitably we wind up turning to what are called factory farming methods, essentially mass production, where animals are crowded together and dosed with drugs and treated cruelly. And so, you know, anybody who doesn't want cruelty on the menu, I think, would rebel against that. But if we just focus on the human health argument, the meat that we are potentially adapted to eat that could fit into a healthy diet is the meat of wild animals. So if you're going to include meat in your diet and you want to do it in a way that's healthy, you know, we all know the expression, Jim, you are what you eat. You know, I think we fail to follow that logic where it leads. If we are what we eat, then what we eat is what it eats. So if you're going to eat meat, you want to eat the meat of animals that are fed well, that are fed their native diet, that are given their native exercise. You do not want to eat the highly processed meat that prevails in modern diets today. But no matter what, you're better off with a diet that is plant predominant. And since so many diets in the modern world include a lot of meat and a lot of processed meat and a lot of dairy, everybody really could and should be encouraged to move in the direction of more plant predominance. You know, you can go all the way. You can have a vegan diet where you don't include any meat or any dairy at all. And certainly that can be a perfectly healthy diet. But, you know, it's not as if there's just one way to improve the quality of diets. The general movement toward plant predominance, you know, there are many variations on that theme. Everything from Mediterranean to flexitarian to pescatarian to vegetarian, all the way to vegan. They're all good, but they're all plant predominant. They all de-emphasize meat. I think when you look across those three domains, ethics, environment, and human health, they all point in the same direction. The less meat in our diets, the better. And then it's up to you to decide what meat you do include, how much and how often.
You know, the thing that really struck me, Nellie, just reading your book, but, you know, taking a look at the Blue Zones, doctor, I have not read a study anywhere in the world where people live primarily on meat and live to be 100 years old and are healthy. And, you know, you almost can boil it down to something simple. If it's in a package, a box, or a can, avoid it. And, you know, you're probably going to be healthier. And when you think of going into a supermarket, if you just go around and do your shopping in the periphery instead of the middle of the store where you have the packages, the cans, and the boxes, you're going to be healthier and better off. Do you think as we get more and more knowledge, for example, your book and others that come out, that we are moving in this direction more towards health? I mean, people know, you know, organic is more prominent now. You go into supermarkets, they have organic fruits and vegetables. You are seeing more celebrities even talk about it. And so it's gaining. Now, one of the things that really struck me is I work out 6 days a week. I got a trainer who basically talked to me about plant-based protein, because most trainers will tell you, oh, you're working out with weights, you're doing that. You need a lot of meat, a lot of protein. And I found one that said, no, you don't have to do that. And he cited people like Tom Brady and others who have been very successful with mainly a plant-based diet.
So you just threw out a bunch of stuff there, Jim. So you're absolutely right. There are no studies showing people living long and enjoying vitality on meat-predominant diets. It doesn't happen. You want a plant-predominant diet. You're also right that the best foods are minimally processed. They're at the periphery of the grocery store. However, living in the modern world, it's very unlikely that you're going to completely avoid items in bags, boxes, bottles, jars, or cans. And I think that's okay. You just want good, clean ingredients in those packages. So, you know, for example, dried beans may come in a package, and, you know, beans and water may come in a can, and marinara sauce made from tomatoes, olive oil, and spices will come in a jar, and steel cut oats may come in a box, and that's all fine. So, you know, it's not as if you have to avoid those middle aisles of the supermarket. You just have to shop them carefully. And then you do want to load up as much as possible on the stuff in the periphery, especially from the produce aisle. So, you know, all of that's really important. And then on this issue of protein, it's very clear that the typical American gets far more protein than we need. And people should realize extra protein beyond what you need doesn't make you strong, doesn't build muscle. It just turns into fat like extra calories from any other source. And the evidence is very clear that plant protein is just as good as animal protein. And, you know, the idea that you have to eat meat to be big and strong, well, you know, maybe you should have that conversation with your friendly neighborhood gorilla or a horse. I mean, you know, basically, animals are adapted to turn what they eat into themselves. It's a you know, wondrous kind of alchemy. Horses can turn oats and grass and hay into mountains of muscle. I have a horse. I'm an equestrian. So I have this magnificent animal, 1,300 pounds of athletic muscle made from oats and grass and hay. So no, you don't have to eat meat to build muscle. It just depends what kind of animal you are. And the kind of animal we are is omnivorous, meaning we have the ability to make muscle out of either plant protein or animal protein. So we have choices. The plant protein sources are better for us overall. Eat more beans, eat more lentils. It's better for your health than eating more beef. So you can make muscle either way. So your trainer's absolutely right. And it's nice to know that there are some enlightened trainers, because I think too many of them do recommend you've got to eat meat if you want to be big and strong. It's just not true. We are a kind of animal that can make muscle perfectly well out of plants, and it's better for our health overall. It's better for the planet overall. So, you know, a few really important messages there. But at the end of all of this, we keep coming back to the same basic message that, you know, the fundamental pattern of a health-promoting diet is perfectly clear. It's based on mountains and mountains of evidence. And fortunately, it's the same kind of dietary pattern that's good for the planet and good for our fellow creatures as well. But there is an awful lot of misinformation between you and a clear, reliable understanding of that basic dietary pattern. And that's what I'm trying to fix.
Well, I tell you, doctor, this is a much needed book. What I really appreciate in what you've done in this book is you've taken a lot of the fallacies, the lies, the myths. You've discussed them, pros and cons, the nuances, but then also you give research and studies to back up the statements you make in your book. And then in the second half, you take the things we actually confront in our diet on a day-to-day basis. As I mentioned, we talked about wine. Maybe in moderation, and depending on everything else you're doing in your diet, you may be okay. But a fabulous, fabulous book. It's called The Truth About Food, Why Pandas Eat Bamboo and People Get Bamboozled by David Katz, who has been my guest. Doctor, fabulous, fabulous book, much needed with all the information we get bombarded with. My congratulations.
Thank you so much, Jim. I really appreciate the kind words, and I thank you for taking this time to discuss it.
You're more than welcome, and happy holidays to you, sir.
The same to you. Thank you.
Well, that concludes my two-part interview with Dr. Katz. And, you know, folks, we've done a number of interviews on this program regarding health. We've had Dr. Caldwell of the China Study, Caldwell Esselstyn from the Cleveland Heart Clinic, Dean Ornish, you name them, authors of The Paleo Diet, The Big Fat Surprise, vegetarian diets, plant-based diets, you name it, we've covered it. But I can tell you, out of all the books I've read and the interviews we've done, one of the best books I read is Dr. Katz's book, The Truth About Food. You're going to find something in there for everyone. I don't care if you're thinking about a particular diet, a particular food, is it good or is it bad? And some of the fallacies that we get subject to on a daily basis. Let's face it, the food industry advertises. Madison Avenue is trying to convince you buying a particular food or a particular diet is good for you. Well, you want to find the truth about all of that? You'll find it in The Truth About Food. I'm Jim Poplava. Thanks for listening.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Please be advised that you invest at your own risk.